Good to see you all. It was cold this morning. Oh, wow. How was that, by the way? Well, yeah, if you don't like touchdowns, it was a great game. But, wow, that's remarkable. I mean, they said it was going to be a defensive struggle, but... Yeah. Well, I've read about them. Okay. And when I saw the News Gazette's, you know, annual quiz, and you know, was asking who has the worst overall record in football in the Big Ten. Well, I was proud as a recovering Hoosier that it was Indiana, but Illinois was right there with them, right? But yeah. Oh, absolutely, sure. It always works that way. Yeah. Yeah. Well, if I may bring our meeting to order, thank you. I'm going to invite you to discuss something else, okay? What's your favorite thing about Easter? What's your favorite thing, or a favorite thing about, maybe the most favorite thing is hard, but what do you... Heroes. Oh, yeah, Heroes, yeah, I like that one too. You know, there's a short list of Easter songs, but they're really good. Yeah.
They used to do, here on Easter Sunday, do the Handel's Messiah, and you could get up and sing even if the whole choir was there.
Uh-huh.
The orchestra.
Okay. Okay. Yeah, yeah. Sing along, Messiah. Yeah, I mean, typically folks do that at Christmas, but it belongs at Easter. Yeah.
I was from a holiday of church and walking into the church, and it was dark on Easter Sunday.
Oh, cool. Yeah. Well, and if you read the story in the Gospels, showing up while it's still dark is kind of part of the narrative. Yeah, yeah. It's really at first light, at the first opportunity, that the women go to the tomb. I'll mention something that I'm a little conflicted about. I love the look of all the Easter lilies in church, but then I get all full of sinus congestion as a result. Okay. So what can you say about that? Somebody else was going to say something. Was it you?
No.
Okay. I thought I saw a hand. Okay. Well, just to think about that. We're going to talk today about Jesus' resurrection. We wouldn't be here if there weren't a resurrection. This is absolutely what drives the whole story. We could spend, you know, if you're getting to know the New Testament, you could spend 16 weeks discussing the resurrection of Jesus, and that would be one way to do it. So let's begin by my kind of laying this down as a big cultural, historical, theological principle, as it were, that comes out of this, and that is that if you lived in the time of Jesus, the concept of resurrection would be something that you would understand was distinctly Jewish. In the larger Greco-Roman world, the only folks who have any notion, any idea, any expectation of resurrection from the dead are Jewish. Okay. Now, first of all, let's define what we mean by resurrection so we can understand why this is a distinctively Jewish concept. Resurrection doesn't simply mean life after death, okay? Sometimes we collapse our categories and we think of, okay, to be raised from the dead means that your spirit is alive even though your body is dead. Well, this is not the concept. Resurrection as a term in the New Testament, as a term which was used in the Judaism of Jesus' time, meant not just the spirit is alive, but the body is made alive as well. So body and spirit made alive again after death. It is the resuscitation of the physical body. And so in that respect, it was a distinctive concept in Judaism for a couple of reasons. The foundational one is that Jewish people believed in a God who created the world and who created it good. Okay? Your pagan friends did not believe that. Over, you know, over here they've got a dragon who cut another dragon in half, and that's why there's a world. And the gods got drunk and had a contest to see who could make the ugliest creature, and the winner made human beings. Okay, these are actual pagan stories of the ancient Near East. Is it any wonder these people just killed anything that moved? You know, it's quite a brutal kind of a story. But Jewish people believe from their scriptures, God created the world and said the world with humans in it is very good. So that's a component. Another component then really has to do with the promise of God. Okay. If we go over on the pagan side, if we were to talk to somebody who didn't believe in the God of Israel who lives in this period, what do they think about life and life after death and the human body and existence, etc.? Well, living is better than dying. Humanity is pretty much agreed on that. Okay, you don't get much of an argument about that. And when people do say, well, I'm not so sure, it's because life has become a kind of living death, really, is what they come to. So living is better than dying, but there's a lot of thinking among Greco-Roman people in this period that sees the body as a kind of a limitation. So if there's anything to be expected after death, if you're talking to your pagan friends, it's probably something that doesn't involve physicality, okay? And so maybe it's a kind of a liberation of the spirit apart from the body so that there's a kind of existence. But nobody's real confident about this, and nobody thinks it's great. They're rarely, if ever, talking about this in terms that they would look forward to. And it's interesting, you look at the what archaeologists call funerary art of the Greco-Roman period, you know, the things that people used to decorate graves. There was some really elaborate sculpture in that kind of thing that was done. You know, if you're rich, once you're dead, what do you spend your money on? You spend it on the place where you're buried, I guess. And so we can get a glimpse of a lot of attitudes towards this. And a lot of these sculptures really represent the kind of permanent separation that death represents, and the mourning and the longing for the one who has departed. So we're not really looking forward to, on the Greco-Roman side, we're not looking forward to any kind of a reunion of any kind on the other side of the grave. We're not thinking, even though we might say, there was a saying used by some folks in this period in Greek, soma sema. Soma means body, sema means prison. So the body, soma sema, the body is a prison. Is a prison, yeah. So you're limited by your body. And so even though they're thinking, okay, maybe I'm leaving the body behind, that's going to liberate the spirit, it's still not a positive, confident view that anybody's got, okay? Now, let's go over on the Jewish side. If we read the Old Testament, the scriptures of Israel, it's surprising how little they say about resurrection from the dead, okay? It's very hard to derive a theology of life after death, or life after life, if you will, from the Old Testament. Okay, now there are instances, multiple instances, where confronted with death, the faithful people of God put their confidence in God. Okay, you know, famously, Job says, "I know my Redeemer lives." Abraham expresses confidence in God as Sarah dies, and he's seeking a burial place for her, and so forth. The 23rd Psalm, one of the best known passages of the Bible. I walk through the valley of the shadow of death. What does that mean? God is with me. Okay, and comforts me in that. So there's all kinds of instances of confidence in God, but nowhere is anyone saying, listen, God is going to raise his people from the dead. Okay, except, there's always an except to these kinds of things, okay, except when you get into some of the prophets, they begin to speak this way, but we're not exactly sure what they're talking about in this sense. And I'll give you a couple of examples of this. One is in Isaiah 26, verse 19. Let me just turn to that and read that. Isaiah 26 and verse 19. Some of these chapters in this section of Isaiah are just really, really interesting. But here's a statement. Your dead shall live, their bodies shall rise. You who dwell in the dust, awake and sing for joy, for your dew is the dew of life, and the earth will give birth to the dead. Now, you're thinking, wait, that sounds pretty straightforward, unequivocal. That sounds like God is going to raise the dead. Here's the deal. When you read that in context, it sounds like a metaphor for God bringing Israel back after exile. Okay. So our nation is in exile, we're dead, okay? And then God says, no, I'm going to raise the dead. So, all right, if I'm reading that, I'm thinking, okay, I know for sure God has said he's going to bring Israel back after exile. What about this raised from the dead thing? Probably just a metaphor, okay? Now, if we jump forward a few generations and we come to the prophet Daniel, he says the same kind of thing. Daniel chapter 12, verse 2 is a good example here. And, you know, it's like these prophets. Every generation, they get a little more intense. So he says, verse 2, I'm looking for the little tiny 2. There it is. And many of those who sleep in the dust of the earth shall awake, some to everlasting life, and some to shame and everlasting contempt. Okay. So that, okay, some yes, others no. So is he, you know, some yes for life, others for a kind of a second death. Is he talking about resurrection, or is this a kind of a division of the nation that happens when it's restored? I don't know. I'm not sure. Now, here's the interesting thing that happens. If we move after the time of the Old Testament to what Christians sometimes call the intertestamental period. Sometimes you'll hear me utter the phrase Second Temple Judaism because we're in the shadow of the University of Illinois. I want to use the terms that, you know, would be recognized in an academic environment, okay? If we're in this period, which leads up to, it includes the period of the New Testament, if you were to talk to Jewish people on the street and ask them, how is God going to be faithful to all of his promises? Most of them would say, oh, he's going to raise his people from the dead. And I mean that he's going to make the dead alive again. Okay. Just about everybody in Judaism in Jesus' time believed this. Just about the Sadducees, no. And that's why they were sad, you see. Okay. Okay. The best jokes are the old jokes. Okay, but other Jewish people believe in resurrection. Now, where is this coming from if it's not taught in their scriptures? We can, so to speak, do the math. Okay, proposition number one, God is faithful to all of his people. Okay, proposition number two, God has promises yet to fulfill. Proposition number three, many of God's people are or will be dead when God fulfills his promises. That raises a question. How can God be faithful to all of his people when he fulfills his promises if some of his folk are dead? And the answer is, he'll raise them from the dead. Any questions? Okay. I mean, you know, in that sense, it's that simple. So this is a fun bit. Sometime you should read the books of the Old Testament Apocrypha. Okay. Don't worry about, no, I don't think they're scripture, but they're really interesting and informative, and some of them are fun to read. Tobit is a crazy story. Somebody should make it into a movie. Okay, it's basically kind of like a Marvel movie in a lot of respects. But one of the books of the Old Testament Apocrypha is called 2 Maccabees. And the seventh chapter of 2 Maccabees is a story of a woman who has seven sons who are all being, they're all standing before the Greek king Antiochus Epiphanes, who is, if you were here the first week and we talked about historical background, he's the guy who tried to outlaw Judaism. in the second century BC, around 166 to 163. And so he was forcing Jewish people to renounce their faith. He has this mother and these seven sons, and he demands, tells all of them, if you don't renounce your faith, I'll torture you, I'll kill you. And they all get off these brilliant speeches, you know, before they die a horrible death. It's a very colorful, passage. And in that passage, for example, one of them says this, and when he was at his last breath, he said, "You accursed wretch, you dismiss us from this present life, but the King of the universe will raise us up to an everlasting renewal of life because we have died for his laws." Now, what's he expressing there? Confident, absolute belief in resurrection from the dead. It's clear, it's unequivocal, this is not a metaphor. Okay, and he is one of seven brothers plus their mom who do it. Okay, they all manage to combine resurrection with insulting the tyrant, which I think is a brilliant way to talk. Okay, what's happened here? Well, in this period when Jewish people are often suffering at the hands of different empires, and when they are impatiently waiting for the fulfillment of God's promises, they develop a belief widely held that God is going to raise people from the dead. Now, by the way, if you ask why did the Sadducees not believe this, were they kind of hard-headed empiricists and scientists who said, oh, God can't do that? No, that's not it at all. The Sadducees thought God had already fulfilled his promises, that he did that with some things that he did to take care of Antiochus and the things that followed. They were very invested in the status quo. And so they were running around saying, this is as good as it gets. And that's another reason they were sad, you see. Okay. Yeah, so if they'd said, well, there's a resurrection coming, they'd be as much as admitting that God hadn't fulfilled all of his promises. Okay. Now, I should mention that today, if you know people of Jewish faith, they probably don't believe in resurrection. And that's because there's a lot of water under the bridge, historically and theologically, that changes the shape of people's faith. So, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Books of the scriptures.
Uh-huh.
It says, I know that my Redeemer lives.
Yes, exactly.
And he will stand up upon this earth, and after my skin has been destroyed, yet in my flesh I will see God. I myself will see him with my own eyes, and I not another. How my heart yearns within me.
Yeah.
And so here,
it is, yes. He does, but I would describe it, I'm taking nothing away from what you said, but in a kind of an oblique way, where even there we're asking, is he speaking literally of resurrection, or is he talking about God standing on the earth and taking this kind of death-like existence that Job has in the present? And I say that because these are the kinds of debates about these texts that people were having at the time. You know, when we listen to them and so forth, so it's here's a different way I would put it. It's there, but we haven't put the pieces together yet, with the way that we will by the time, you know, we're on the threshold of Jesus' arrival, where everybody says, well, of course God's going to raise people from the dead, and he's been talking about this the whole time, and we need to listen to that. Yeah. So it's kind of the way that we look back at texts that promise the coming of the Messiah, and we see them differently when we're kind of on the other side of that. Yeah. So yeah, it's there. It's all the way through. It's all the way there, but with a sort of a semi-opaque screen over it, as it were.
But in a sense, these are words of hope.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yes. Absolutely. They're words of hope. And I think the key thing to see is, and I think we need to come back to this in the way we think about this ourselves, they're words of hope that are grounded in the faithfulness of God. Yeah. I mean, that's where we begin. God is faithful. You know, that's the first mark in this. So it's not simply we have this teaching. It's like, okay, God is faithful. Whatever is going on here, God is faithful. And that's helpful. Yeah, I appreciate you bringing that up. Yeah, let me kind of one more time. This has to happen every week. If you think of it, then it looks like this in what people are expecting. If you are a godly Jewish person of the Second Temple period, this is how you understand life, the universe, and everything, including resurrection. Right now, we suffer, we die, and dead people remain dead. Okay? But when God fulfills his promises, everything's great, and he raises his people from the dead. Okay? That's your expectation. Yes, unless a grain of wheat falls and dies, which is what Jesus, as he talks about his own resurrection, which is a wonderful transition, okay? Because let's now talk about Jesus' resurrection. It's very important when we're reading any of the Gospels that we realize Jesus talks about his resurrection before it happens, okay? He talks about his death before it happens. He talks about his resurrection before it happens. Last week we made the point that if we're reading Matthew, Mark, Luke, the synoptic gospels, as we call them, synoptic so-called because they're so similar, they see together, when Peter says, "You are the Christ," Jesus then says, "I'm going to Jerusalem, I'll be handed over to the Gentiles, I'll be crucified, 3 days later I'll rise." And they don't understand. So Jesus says this kind of thing repeatedly, including with the rise bit. Now, sometimes it's with a metaphor. Grain of wheat falls and dies, but then it grows. Okay. And this is in, what, John chapter 12, where Jesus speaks in this way. He is repeatedly emphasizing the idea that he will rise from the dead. Now, we might listen to that and think, how in the world could they not understand that? How in the world could they not understand that? Well, let's think about this. You believe that God raises the dead. When God raises the dead, how many of his people does he raise? All of them. Okay. And that marks the end of the present evil age and the beginning of the age of fulfillment. Used to be able to say new age, but that's all, you know, we kind of blew that out of the water 25 years ago. So all of God's people raised from the dead. Jesus says, God's going to raise me from the dead. That doesn't fit your paradigm, okay? That doesn't match up. And, you know, you're accustomed to these oblique statements that involve metaphors of resurrection and the difficulty of understanding them, et cetera, and all of it just kind of, you know, it's bouncing off your consciousness in this way. But Jesus speaks of this repeatedly in this way, but no one is expecting it. Okay, that combination is important.
Mm-hmm. No one is expecting it. I think, did they lose Jesus as soon as he said, "And I'm going to suffer and die"?
That as well.
That, you know, suffer and die, I have invested 3 years of my life following you. I'm expecting to be vice president. How will you say die?
Dying is a really bad way to become king. Yeah. Yeah, exactly. So I've lost it there. This die rise thing. What in the world does this mean? I may rebuke you. I may admit I don't understand. It just I can't make sense of any of it. Yeah.
So they kind of tune out.
Yeah, exactly. And I've got enough murkiness about resurrection language that it can compound that. Yeah. Look in any direction, and you can appreciate why they don't understand. It's not because they're stupider than we are. I mean, we're all roughly equally stupid, you know.
Well, that also, in a sense, makes the resurrection more magnificent.
It does.
The disciples who came and stole his body.
Right. I mean, and the unexpectedness of it is very, very important. Okay. Now, Jason is next door, and we're gonna horn in on some of his territory, because I do want to talk about how we can have historical confidence that this event took place. Okay, Jason's doing, you know, the intellectual coherence of the Christian faith, and this is very much key to it. That either the stories of Jesus' resurrection are based on the memories of those who saw him raised from the dead, or they are legendary, or theological metaphors, as it were. Definitely, definitely. But yeah, we'll unpack that. A couple of other things. I made an outline, and so, which is always a dangerous thing to do, because you want to follow it. Let's talk about some of the details of the story of Jesus' resurrection. All four Gospels tell us that it is the women at the tomb who are the first to be witnesses of the resurrection. And that's interesting for several reasons. First of all, if you were making a story up and wanted it to be credible, I don't make the rules, I just report them. In the Greco-Roman world, whether you were Jewish or Gentile, you wouldn't tell a story about female witnesses if you wanted the story to be believed, okay, because they're considered to be less reliable. Now, the whole story of Jesus is about exalting the lowly, so we're not surprised. This is the way it comes down. But it's very unlikely that a story would be created that would involve that in that way. And of course, if we read it, we see to some extent in several of the narratives, it admits the male disciples didn't believe the women, you know. It's very clear in Luke. Now these women say Jesus has been raised from the dead. Who can believe that? Is part of what's going on. But it's interesting too. If you look at what early opponents of Christianity said about the resurrection of Jesus, one of the things that they criticized was, well, you say he raised from the dead, but you don't have any story of him coming out of the tomb. Okay. There's no story of his emergence from the tomb. And so you think, wait a minute, isn't there? No, there's not. Okay. The nearest you come is in Matthew, where Matthew tells us about the soldiers who were at the tomb in Matthew 28. He says an angel comes down and moves the stone, and this freaks these guys. Okay. But they don't see Jesus come out. So This was something that in the early second century, criticism of Christianity, if he rose from the dead, why don't you have a story of Jesus coming out of the tomb? Well, as people do, somebody wrote a story of Jesus coming out of the tomb. Okay, now it's crazy. Okay, first there's a cross that comes out of the tomb, and then it goes up into the sky and starts talking. And then Jesus is led out of the tomb with an angel on either elbow. Okay, it's this fantastical, probably mid-second century AD. Okay, now here's the important thing. Christians thought this was bunk. Okay, they did not accept it. They didn't say, oh, our critics say we need a story of Jesus coming out of the tomb. Here's one, or, oh, I think I could do better. No, they knew the difference between the stories that they had from the beginning and the things that would suit their purposes. Okay, I think that's important. So many people have made the observation, the tomb is empty, Jesus is not there, and the stone is moved not to let Jesus out, but to let everybody else in to see that. Okay. But, again, let's do the math. The tomb is empty, Jesus' body is not there, and here's this guy who looks like Jesus, including with the wounds, telling us that he's Jesus, and he's raised just as he said, okay, and all of this. I think that's him in the same body he died in. Okay. So as we put the story together, we see how it doesn't read like something that is created by early Christians, but it reads like something which was witnessed and reported, with all of the ways in which the people who are telling the story actually look bad in the way that they're telling it. It does not enhance them or their reputations. Yes, yes, yeah, and we have multiple meetings. And all of them are emphasizing different things. In Matthew, after the angel says, go tell, by the way, pay attention to what the angel says to the women, especially in Matthew and Mark. Go tell the disciples and Peter. Okay. Tell the knuckleheads, especially the number one knucklehead. Okay. That's really the way that goes. So, you know, it's not go find me 12 better guys because they blew it. Go tell the disciples and Peter. They should meet him in Galilee. In Luke, Jesus appears to the two on the road to Emmaus. That's an absolutely fascinating story in Luke chapter 24 because there's so many things going on. These guys tell the story and they said, and we hoped that he would be the one who'd redeem Israel. And they say to Jesus at the beginning, he says, what are you talking about? Jesus of Nazareth, who's he? Are you the only person around here who doesn't know this story? No, he's the only one who really does know the story, you know, at this stage. But they don't know that it's him. When they arrive at their home, finally, you get this little play where Jesus says he's going to go on, and they insist that he stays in their home, which is kind of like fighting over the check at the end of the meal. It's something you're supposed to do, you know, but you really, you know how it's supposed to end. So Jesus comes into the home as the guest, but he acts as the host and takes the bread and breaks it. Now, very interesting in Luke, Jesus says in the upper room, I will not eat of this bread until I eat it with you new in the kingdom. So it's very interesting that when you come to the Emmaus story, that Luke draws attention to the fact that they're eating. Okay, as if to say, the kingdom has come, the kingdom has arrived. Why? Because God has raised Jesus from the dead. Okay, and along the way, Jesus is saying the whole of the law and the prophets are saying the Messiah must die and be raised from the dead, and then salvation proclaimed to the Gentiles. This is the culmination of the entire story, as we talked about last week. In Matthew, after the angel appears to the women, Jesus speaks to the women. In John, Jesus speaks to Mary Magdalene. We have that interesting thing that is said where it's translated in the King James Version, don't touch me, but it's used as a Greek verb tense that implies a continuing action. And so it's probably more like, don't hold on to me. So it's as if Jesus is saying, this resurrection is a moment leading to something bigger. And that leads us to another observation that we'll make in a minute. There is, of course, a commissioning in these narratives as well. John's gospel is very interesting because in the upper room, Jesus says, after the upper room, before his death, he says, he prays, as you have sent me into the world, so I am sending them into the world. And then after his resurrection, he says, as the Father has sent me, so I am sending you. Says the same thing on either side. Of course, we have the Great Commission in Matthew, which is very famous, to make disciples of all nations. In Luke, wait in Jerusalem till you receive power from on high. And then that's coupled with Acts that kind of overlaps Luke, like, you know, overlapping pieces of lumber. You will be my witnesses in Jerusalem, Judea, and Samaria, to the ends of the earth. So this is announcing God in this age of fulfillment is going to be king of the whole world. He's taking the world back. Is there something? There seems to me there was something else there I wanted to mention. What was it? Oh, heavens, I have no idea. Oh, well. Okay, now, let's think about this, and it's probably just as well because we need to move on to some other things. Let's think about this. What has happened to our expectation, okay? We're thoughtful, godly Jewish people believing that God raises his people from the dead. When he fulfills his promises, he makes the world right. This is all of God's people at the end of the present age and the beginning of the age to come. And now what has happened? God has raised Jesus from the dead. But outwardly, everything else looks the same. It's as if God has taken this and pulled it back into the middle. Okay? So the end of this, the beginning of the new age has come even while the present age is continuing. Jesus has been raised from the dead. So this is what Paul is going to say in 1 Corinthians. He is the first fruits of those who have fallen asleep. And that isn't just a promise of the future, it's also an indication of the transformation of the present. Because in the present, I am also being raised from the dead. Let's think about how this works out elsewhere in the New Testament. Paul compares baptism to resurrection in Romans chapter 6. You have been raised to walk in new life. Okay, you are living a resurrection life. The power of God's resurrection, the fulfillment of his promises, the promises of the new age are already at work in you through faith in Jesus. God has given his spirit to his people, empowering them to live the life of resurrection, a life which changes them and transforms them. Now, outwardly, you know, everything is still pretty much the same. The bad guys seem to be in charge. I have sciatica. Okay. You can just go through the whole list. Okay. By the way, yoga helps. Okay. If any of you are interested, I will share my YouTube videos with you. Okay. And tell you how awkwardly I do them. Why are all these people who do yoga so perfectly flexible? You know, I can barely bend over. You know, Everywhere I look, I see all kinds of indications of the badness of the present. But the life of God is in me and gives me strength and vision and hope and power, you know, in the present. And I see around me the power of God manifested in the way that people are being transformed from death to life.
Well, when Jesus died, and the disciples and the women saw Jesus die.
Yeah. Oh my gosh, yes.
Horrible,
yeah.
Hopeless time ever.
Yeah.
And then to see Jesus, you know, resurrected, there's,
yeah.
It says they were filled with joy.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Just this is complete transformation.
Football game last night.
When they got that last field goal. Oh, and it was called back? Oh, I see.
So the Alliance just like almost lost practically. And then the ref says, oh, the play was dead because his arm touched the ground and they call it back. And so
see, I was watching baseball. I didn't know what was going on.
A touchdown, they were, you know, there was a lot of joy and excitement.
Reading.
Yeah, reading. So, but I mean,
I will allow your comparison.
Yeah, but the disciples were really discouraged.
Oh, my, yes. Yeah. Yeah.
No,
not at all. Not at all. And this is, this reminds me of a story. Have I got time for a story? I've got time for a story. Okay. I was a graduate student at the University of Aberdeen, and tragically, there was a student there from Central Africa, Uganda, maybe. Not positive. I don't think it was Uganda. Anyway, regardless, who unfortunately he had taken his own life. He jumped out of a window, and there was a memorial service for him, and a lot of us attended. And there was a bishop from his church in Uganda who came to speak at this memorial. And he used as his text the statement of the two men on the road to Emmaus, we had hoped that he was the one who would redeem Israel. And he used this to say, you know, we had such high hopes for this young man, and now our hopes have evaporated. And he left it right there. You know, And I thought, what in the world is going on with this? And then there was a pastor of one of the local churches that this student had been a part of while he was in Aberdeen, who got up to give the prayer at the end. And he, in his prayer, gave a ringing, confident declaration of resurrection from the dead. And all of us just left saying, oh, well, you know, thank God for that benediction, because there was just something missing without that. And, you know, in retrospect, I'd say you've got to have both of those things. You've got to understand the depth of the despair, you know, to really appreciate the nature of the expectation of resurrection and the reality of it in what they see. Yeah, the reality of it. Yes, it does. Now, let's also mention that we need to connect Jesus' ascension to this as well. Now, fun fact, in the 27 books of the New Testament, the only ones that mention Jesus' ascension are Luke and Acts. Okay? It's not mentioned anyplace else. However, the entire New Testament just sort of assumes that it is true. And here's why. The entire New Testament expresses or implies or assumes that Jesus died, that he rose in the body he died in, leaving his tomb empty, and that he appeared to his disciples, but for a limited period of time. And then he didn't appear anymore, with one exception, which was to Paul, Saul, and that he reigns in heaven. Okay, well, again, do the math. What does that mean? He must have left here and gone there. And so this is what we mean by ascension. So Luke narrates this ascension because he wants to link together the story of Jesus with the story of the early church, which we will talk about next week. But this idea is important. Jesus is not just alive, he is also enthroned. He is in the place of authority. This is why his followers receive the Spirit and not the other people. Now, this is what Peter's going to say at Pentecost. What does this mean? We've received the Spirit, us, the followers of Jesus. What does that mean? Jesus is king. Not just king, he's God, because who else can pour out God's Spirit? So what does that mean for you who called for his death? Oops. Okay, but that's next week's lesson. Okay. They're empowered by the Spirit. So as we think about this, as we think, okay, what does this upper line mean here? Well, in our experience, that's a big part of that is being empowered by the Spirit. It's being empowered and directed by God to live as God's person in the world, in the midst of all this other stuff that we continue to experience. Mm-hmm.
When you showed the box like that, I always think of it like the New York Stock Exchange.
Uh-huh.
You know, arrows up and down.
Mostly down lately, yeah. A few dead cat bounces, but okay.
But
enough about my retirement.
A lot of uncertainty.
Yes. Yes. Exactly. Yeah. We're graphing our stuff up and yeah, absolutely up and down with that. But you stop and say, okay. And this is a terrible analogy. If you're a stock investor, over time it always goes up. Okay. What if it doesn't? Then we'll all be poor, so it won't make any difference. But more importantly here, what is God doing? He is raising his people from the dead. What's the worst that can happen to you? You'll die. God will raise his people from the dead. Yeah, that perspective, you know, then becomes very important. Yes. And we will doubtless talk about this as we get into the letters, because this is another expression of the faithfulness of God. Well, if we're not raised from the dead yet, what does it mean if we die? Well, God is faithful, so he never abandons his people. To be absent from the body is to be at home with the Lord. And when the Lord returns, he brings those who have died with him, and they are, okay, but that's 1 Thessalonians. That's in 2 weeks, I think. Okay, so there we go with that. Now, I want to get back in a little bit to the, are we, you know, why are we confident that this happened? As I said, they're really, at this point, you know, in history, if we bounced over to the university, to the religious studies department, or anyone who might have an interest in this, we think, well, you know, don't they see all this evidence? The discussion would be, well, certainly early Christians told the story of Jesus' resurrection. But they did so, some would argue, as an expression of their deep faith that Jesus was alive with God and that his power and his purpose was still at work in the world. So they told stories of resurrection as a way of saying that. And so stories of Jesus appearing were really stories that were told to express, I deeply believe that he is still alive with God. See how that would work? Okay. In other words, a lot of us are used to, you know, well, the disciples didn't steal the body, they didn't go to the wrong tomb and so forth. All of those kinds of things that many of us have cut our teeth on. Very true, very logical. But those aren't really taken seriously in historical academic studies these days because they're easily explained. What folks would say is, these are ways of expressing the Christians had their beliefs, sometimes maybe accompanied by private visionary experiences, that Jesus was alive with God and still powerful. Here's the problem. Here's with that hypothesis. The term resurrection meant something specific in Judaism in this period. It did not mean still alive with God even though the body is dead. They had a whole vocabulary for that. And it didn't use the word resurrection. Resurrection meant the reanimation of the physical body. Resurrection is body and spirit reunited because God made the world good and God is going to restore the world. Okay. What's unusual about the usage with Jesus is that it's coming in the middle of history, not at the end of history. You know, that's what's unusual. But the meaning there is very clear. Now, secondly, Christians are very clear on the idea, and Paul says this best in 1 Corinthians 15. You know, he died according to the scriptures, he was buried, he rose, and he appeared to... Okay, and then, last of all, like one untimely born, he appeared to me. Now, what he's saying there is, resurrection appearances are in the past. They stopped. Okay, Jesus appeared a while, and then he stopped appearing. He made a special appearance for me. That wasn't just a vision that I had. He was there in the flesh on the road to Damascus. Okay, and he doesn't appear anymore. If Christians were saying, I saw Jesus as a way of saying, I really believe in Jesus, there would be no limits on this. They would continue to talk that way.
What do you think about some reports that there are people who've had a vision?
Now, this is important too. There's a whole vocabulary in Jewish usage of Greek that applies to visionary experiences. And Paul talks about that. Okay, Paul talks about receiving visions, for example, in 2 Corinthians. That's different language. Okay, there's a different way of describing that. As a Jewish person in this period, I would use different terms to refer to seeing you today and say having a vision of someone who had died, seeing my mom or dad, for example, something like that. Okay. I can talk about both of those things, but I use different terms for it. Okay. So either these people are using language in a way that is coherent and they mean this, or who knows what they mean. Okay. And so we're kind of stuck in a good way saying, yeah, I think the tomb was empty. I think that he was very tangible, eating fish and stuff. And this is important because it tells me that, okay, maybe you've heard people say, and that's my reminder that it's 10 minutes till preach time. Maybe you've heard people say, oh, Christians are too heavenly minded to be of any earthly good. I find this to be false in nearly every instance. Okay. And a part of the reason it's false is that we're not just looking to escape the world. We're looking for God to take his world back And a part of that means that what we are doing in the world now in the name of Jesus is actually building towards that. Even though it's not complete until Jesus comes back and makes all things new, I can't make all things new. But what I'm doing in the name of Jesus, which in small ways is bringing God's will to earth as it is in heaven, somehow builds towards that. And will be enduring and will be celebrated and remembered and learned about. If you ever wonder what you're going to do in eternity, I think a part of it is going to be listening to everybody else's story, which is going to be pretty amazing. And then there'll be new stories to tell. Okay, endless stories. Thoughts, questions, comments, observations that you can make in 30 seconds or less. That's a way of just shutting it down right there. Yeah. Thank you all. It's a lot of fun. See you again sometime soon or upstairs.